Hello there. Today is Tuesday, October the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, despite concerns that Turkey will ramp up its assault as a ceasefire is set to expire, President Trump defends his decision to pull U.S. troops out.
We never agreed to, you know, protect the Kurds. We fought with them for 3.5 to 4 years. We never agreed to protect the Kurds for the rest of their lives.
Democrats look to streamline the focus of their impeachment inquiry. Also had an American-founded school in Somaliland that is achieving success like never imagined. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump says it's a foregone conclusion that the Democratic-led House of Representatives will vote to impeach him over his request that Ukraine investigate a political rival as he pushed for his fellow Republicans to rally to his defense. Trump making the comments at the beginning of a cabinet meeting at the White House and pushed Republicans to step it up, claiming Democrats are more loyal to their own colleagues.
Two things they have. They're vicious and they stick together. They don't have Mitt Romney in their midst. They don't have people like that.
Well, this is the Washington Post is reporting that Trump's conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and others reinforced his perception of Ukraine as a hopelessly corrupt country. Joining us now to unpack all of it is former Central Intelligence Agency officer Jack Rice. He's currently a criminal defense attorney. Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
What does this Washington Post report tell you about Trump's alleged efforts to press Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden?
You know, it really shows how isolated the president is. He's already rejected a lot of the advice from a lot of his senior diplomats in the intelligence community, the Justice Department. I mean, he was ignoring what the Secretary of Defense Mattis was saying, his chief of staff John Kelly was saying, even his senior foreign policy advisor John Bolton was saying. And what ends up happening is he starts listening to the likes of Vladimir Putin, Prime Minister Orban, and this is the net result. They have an agenda, and he seems to be biting on that agenda.
Well, Nancy Pelosi's statement recently that all roads to Donald Trump lead to Russia, would this be an example, or is this something different?
No, actually, this actually ties directly into that. If you look at the likes of Paul Manafort, again, the president's campaign chairman early on, there was a direct connection to the Russians and Ukraine, strangely. And if you look at what we have right now, this takes us back to the president listening and having Vladimir Putin sort of whispering in his ear and having him listen rather than understanding that Putin actually has, again, that agenda, which is a Russian agenda, certainly not an American one.
So Democrats are working to narrow the focus of their impeachment inquiry to abuse of power over this whole issue. House Democrats released a fact sheet and a video. They're trying to make their case. But it seems like it's been a challenge, given that every witness seems to open up more potential people to talk to and things to look into. If they stick to one issue, then what happens with regard to some of these other things that are potential violations?
I think it's going to be difficult to focus in on one issue. I mean, if we look back at what even happened to Bill Clinton, it started out with a land deal that ended up talking about a blue dress. And I recognize you never know how this is going to play out. But I think that part of what the Democrats are going to have to do here is convince a much larger swath of America that it's not just about this issue. It's about other issues that matter, because you're going to need more people to drive the Republicans to agree with them if they're actually going to be successful.
Well, it looks like the president's protection by Republicans, for the most part, holding, but not quite as much as it has. I mean, it slowly seems like there are starting to be some cracks. Do you think more will come forward to the point where they are more worried about protecting themselves and their own reputations rather than getting caught up in his legal troubles?
Well, we have certainly seen people moving forward, and as more and more evidence, more and more information comes out, what we are seeing is that survival mechanism that's going to kick in for the rest of Congress. In the end, it seems clear that Republicans love this president right now or are afraid of his supporters right now. But the less support that he receives and the more they're concerned about their own survival, the more they're going to be pulling away from this president. So that's what people are watching for.
Oh, so that would mean maybe tie into the Democrats working to narrow their focus and making the case for impeachment, I would imagine.
Exactly.
So lastly, the next person testifying before these committees in the House is Bill Taylor, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, one of the people who spoke out about the scheme in real time as it was happening. How significant could his testimony be?
Well, I think it could be huge. Ambassador Taylor is well-respected in the first place. He was essentially retired. They pulled him out of retirement to take this position. He wasn't happy to do it in the first place. And I think his whole point was he saw manipulation in the service, in the State Department, and his willingness to come back in and talk about what he saw and what it means. I think he looks at this much bigger than a question of left and right, Democrats and Republicans. This is more of an attack on the country as a whole, and he wants to articulate what that means and why it means something and why people should be listening to it and looking at it.
Do you think we'll find out anything about what he tells the committees behind closed doors?
Yes, I do. I think what we're seeing now is this is an effort to say why this matters. This is about something more than just a president who's picked up the phone and called a foreign leader and said, do me a favor. This is about something bigger, and this may get deeper than that. And if what this is about this president benefiting himself, I think that's something that you're going to see a lot of moderates looking at saying, that's not something we want from our president, any president.
All right. We appreciate your perspective so much. That's former Central Intelligence Agency officer, current criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, just over a year left until the 2020 U.S. presidential election, and Facebook is now stepping up its efforts to ensure that it is not used as a tool to interfere in politics and democracies around the world. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg says they've made big changes since the last presidential election.
We've gone from being on our back foot to now proactively going after some of the biggest threats that are out there. We built systems to fight interference that we believe are more advanced than what any other company is doing.
In a conference call, Zuckerberg says they've already disposed 50 clusters of fake accounts.
The initial clusters that we saw were primarily from Russia. And more recently, we have seen increasing sophistication and attacks emanating from Iran and China as well.
And there will also be a special security tool for elected officials and candidates that monitors them for hacking attempts. I'm Shelley Adler.
U.S. forces crossed into Iraq from northeastern Syria Monday, part of the broader withdrawal from the region that was ordered by President Donald Trump ahead of a Turkish incursion. Some analysts say that the U.S. retreat from parts of Syria creates a vacuum for countries like Russia, with President Vladimir Putin set to meet with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Tuesday. Later today for high-stakes talks on what happens next in Syria. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from Washington.
As a convoy of U.S. troops crossed from northern Syria into Iraq, civilian Kurds hurled potatoes and insults at the retreating forces. Some yelled, "Go, America, liar!" At the White House, President Donald Trump defended the withdrawal. Democrats and Republicans have criticized the move for abandoning longtime U.S. allies, the Kurds, to slaughter by the Turks.
We're working with the Kurds. We have a good relationship with the Kurds. But we never agreed to, you know, protect the Kurds. We fought with them for 3.5 to 4 years. We never agreed to protect the Kurds for the rest of their lives.
The sudden U.S. withdrawal from Syria deals a blow to America's credibility as a reliable ally, say many members of Congress. Analysts agree.
Many around the region, from Saudi Arabia to Israel to Jordan, are looking very closely at U.S. actions with the Kurds, who are our frontline fighters in the challenge to defeat ISIS militarily. And they're taking a big lesson from it and essentially saying, look, America is a country that maybe we can't rely upon anymore.
Other analysts say the main beneficiary of the U.S. retreat is Russia.
If the U.S. Withdraws troops and thus reduces its influence in the Middle East, obviously somebody's going to take advantage of that. And it's primarily Russia with this newly resurgent foreign policy under Putin, particularly in the Middle East, that's taking advantage of it.
Turkish President Erdogan is meeting with Russian President Putin in Sochi Tuesday to discuss what the next steps will be in Syria.
The thing I'm interested in seeing in this meeting is whether Putin tries to constrain Erdogan in Turkey in any way.
Turkey and Russia have been cooperating closely in recent months. Turkey's purchase of the Russian S-400 missile system in July angered Washington and raised the prospect of U.S. sanctions on Ankara. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
Well, meanwhile, as the five-day ceasefire between Turkish and Kurdish forces in northern Syria is set to expire, some fighting is reported to be continuing. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Tal Tamar in the outskirts of Ras Al Ayn in Syria.
Sporadic fighting has continued despite the ceasefire that was signed Thursday, and there have been reports of deaths and injuries. A convoy of ambulances picked up about 30 people from Ras Al Ayn on Saturday and recovered five bodies. More than 200,000 people have been displaced since Turkey declared its intention to create a buffer zone and expel the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, which it regards as terrorists. Families here say unless the Turkish-backed Syrian fighters that have occupied Ras Al Ayn are out of the city, they will not return home.
If they retreat, of course we will go back. Otherwise, we will have no choice but to stay here where food, water, everything is a problem.
The ceasefire agreement officially expires Tuesday night, and hospitals here are already stretched to the limit. So far, hundreds of people have died.
The number is much more than this, because some people are still missing inside. And it's hard to identify people when their faces were destroyed by an airstrike.
This is the last checkpoint controlled by Kurdish-led forces. Soldiers here say they believe that Turkish-backed fighters are about 2 kilometers away, and they expect this point may be attacked as well soon. Reporting from the outskirts of Ras Al Ayn, I'm Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. has quietly reduced the troop force size in Afghanistan by 2,000. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has failed to form a new Israeli government. Guns, mercenaries, and minerals as Russia embraces Africa. And major U.S. drug companies have reached a $215 million settlement in the U.S. opioid case. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A senior North Korean military official says the United States and South Korea need to produce new solutions for the current standoff on the Korean Peninsula. The statement on Monday warned that what is called hostile policies toward Pyongyang would lead to serious consequences. International Edition's Steve Miller talked about it with Harry Kazianis, Korea Studies Director at the Center for the National Interest, who explained exactly what seems to be happening here.
I think it's very simple. The clock is ticking. I think the North Koreans are making it very clear through all different sorts of statements over the last 2 to 3 months that they're getting very impatient with the United States. I think they were under the assumption that the United States was going to offer some sort of deal, that the United States was going to offer some sort of step-by-step approach, which is what the North Koreans have been asking for a long time. And it seems pretty clear that either the United States is unwilling, unable, or just locked into impeachment chaos in Washington now.
Is it more than just that? Because the impeachment is one thing, but this is also an election cycle. And there's also the business going on in the Middle East with Syria and Turkey and the Islamic State group.
You're 100% right. So what ends up happening is what happens many times in Northeast Asia, that the problems with North Korea drop to number 5 or number 6 on Washington's radar. And that's when we have a history of North Korea getting a little antsy and deciding to raise the temperature a little bit. That's why I think when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st and we go into 2020, we are going to be back to a time of tension. I think there's no doubt about it at this point.
Well, you bring up New Year's Day because that is the time when Kim Jong-un gives essentially his policy speech, so to speak, his New Year's address. And we go back in, even, you know, this year, the 2019, and what he laid out and his goals for discussions and disarmament and denuclearization. Should we put more weight onto what is printed on the 2020 January 1st address?
Absolutely, because the North Koreans, it seems like every single time he makes that speech, he literally tells us what he is going to do. A lot of us that study Korea always, you know, unravel in the mystery of North Korea, and a lot of times there is a lot of things that they do that we don't understand, but the North Koreans make it very clear where they're headed. They told us back in 2017 that they were going to test ICBMs. Guess what? They did it. And there's a whole litany of things that you could go back to in these speeches that show that they're going to, they always try to, what they say they try to do. And I think in 2020, it's going to be no exception. I think what Kim is going to tell us is that he is turning the page with the United States and that his new way is probably going to be a combination of sanctions busting, allying with China and Russia, probably doing tests of more provocative weapons going into the spring, perhaps even an ICBM test. And then it's going to really be important for Washington to figure out how they're going to respond. And I don't think anybody really knows what the Trump administration is going to do, considering some of his actions in Syria recently.
All right. That's Harry Kazianis, Korea Studies Director at the Center for the National Interest, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. U.S. President Donald Trump is lashing out at Democrats and the media after criticism prompted him to cancel his plan to hold a meeting for leaders of major industrialized countries at one of his properties in Florida. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports.
The president is saying concerns about constitutional violations aired by Democrats and Republicans alike if he had hosted the G7 summit at his Doral resort are phony and should not matter because he is already rich.
It would have been great, but the Democrats went crazy, even though I would have done it free.
The president says his administration is now looking at other locations, but none of them he expects will be as exciting or as good. Steve Herman, VOA News at the White House.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed, voanews.com.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. A school in Somaliland, just north of Hargeisa, founded by a wealthy American 10 years ago, is making headlines for its incredible achievements. The high standard of education at Abarso has led to more than 70 female alumni of the school earning full scholarships to colleges in the U.S. and Europe. Joining us now to talk more about this is reporter Amy Gutman in London, who just got back from visiting the school. Amy, tell us all about the Abarso School.
This school is really interesting and really unique because it's the first of its kind. So it wasn't started by a bunch of teachers. It wasn't started by any teachers. In fact, it was started by a gentleman named Jonathan Starr. He's an American who made his money on Wall Street as a financier. And he made enough money where he could easily take an early retirement and decided that he wanted to give back in some way. And so somehow he wound up in Somaliland, untold through family connections. And he quickly understood that there was an incredibly low literacy rate in the country. And part of the reason why is because Somaliland never actually got a written language until the early 1970s, which is very recent. And so because their language is so recent, And because they've had a lot of civil war and conflict, there isn't a very big or strong education system established. So he wanted to change that, and he set about creating this school with very high standards, but he did it more like a startup, more like a business.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think that's why it's been so successful.
In what ways has it been successful?
Most of their graduates get full scholarships to attend universities in America, and more than 70 of their female alumni have earned full scholarships to colleges in the U.S. and Europe, along with the Ivy League. Now, both men and women graduates have been accepted to the Ivy League. So the first female graduate of the school, which is called the Barstow High School, is currently at Yale, another at Columbia. Another recent female graduate of the very first class to graduate from a Barstow now works at the World Bank in New York. What's special about this is not just the kind of person he is and how he started this school and the high standards, but it's the incredible success rate that they're churning out and that they're keeping up from a country where there's such little infrastructure.
So is it expanding?
It is growing. The school is largely staffed by volunteer teachers from North America, the UK, and Europe, and it has already expanded to establish a teaching college specifically for women. This is the first of its kind in the country, and another female alumni from the school has returned from America to begin teaching at a Barstow's first primary school, which just recently opened for the autumn semester. And these educations that this school is providing are very highly sought after. It's important to note that, 1,800 students apply every year for just 48 slots. So this is really considered an incredible opportunity to gain an education and gain a future.
It's simply high school, correct?
So the original school is for high school.
Mm-hmm.
They just opened their first primary school, and they also have recently established this teaching college. And they hope to open more, but essentially now they sort of got from kindergarten through to 22, as it were, through to college. So they at least now have three schools that really cover the full spectrum of education.
And all these teachers are volunteers?
They're all volunteers who want to give back, who want to spend some time in a very remote place in Africa. They all come from different reasons, and they can spend a series of months, and some people spend a couple of years.
Well, it's great that so many women and girls are having such success there, and now I understand they're also going to have a woman at the helm.
That's right. So I was able to meet the new headmaster. She's the first woman to head up a Barstow High School. Her name is Trudy Hall, and she came from a very prestigious girls' prep school in upstate New York and is very excited to take over. She spent quite a few months in the run-up to this coming December, which is when she'll take over the reins, just getting to know the students, understanding the culture, and really getting her head around the differences between teaching at a very affluent, upscale school on the East Coast of America and being in a fairly remote place. I mean, it's a good hour outside of Somaliland's capital city. Picture unpaved roads and sort of fields for miles. So it's a very different atmosphere, and she's really spent some time, several months now, just getting stuck in and understanding the challenges and just getting stuck in and understanding the challenges, but also the positive aspects of working in this kind of community.
All right, that's reporter Amy Gutman on her visit to the Barstow School in Somaliland. Thanks for being with us.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the Migraine Research Foundation, migraines are an extraordinarily prevalent neurological disease affecting 1 billion people worldwide. To many who suffer from migraines, they are more than just a bad headache. A migraine attack can last anywhere from 4 to 72 hours, and for many can be accompanied by other symptoms such as vision difficulty, nausea, vomiting, dizziness, and sensitivity to sound, light, touch, and smell. Factors like the weather, sleep disturbances, hormonal changes, stress, certain medications, and foods or beverages have been known to trigger a migraine attack. Researchers at three Boston medical institutions have released a new study that suggests a link between drinking three or more caffeinated beverages a day with a migraine attack. They also found drinking one or two caffeinated beverages a day did not set off a migraine. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Lady Gaga, who had a scary fall during one of her recent concerts, posted an X-ray of her arm on Instagram, and she also assured her fans that she's okay. It happened in Las Vegas at the start of her Enigma residency. Gaga invited a fan on stage. She jumped into his arms, and both of them tumbled and fell off the stage. She reassured the audience that it was fine, and she jumped back on stage and continued the performance. But Gaga also really made it a point for the fan to promise that he would not feel bad about the accident. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show
designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
This is VOA.